Is advised.
All righty. Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, June 23rd, 2021, and thanks for joining us for the 111th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you very much for that. And if you would, please let us know the name of the song and the artist, although I think I've guessed, and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Well, I suspect everybody who has listened to the radio at any time in their life, and they're over, 10 years old, probably knows that song. So that was Every Breath You Take from The Police. And given the topic this evening, I thought that would be a very cute intro to the what we're going to be discussing tonight in regards to the stalking phenomena.
Absolutely, yes. That was my guess. And I was kind of wondering if that one would come up tonight. I also wondered about Just a Job to Do by Genesis, although that's a little more professional stalking, but still relevant. All
yeah,
right, so...
Yeah, you know, any stalking board of the storm, right?
Oh, Lord. And, you know, that's actually a great example of something we're going to talk about later, because you have all these fun songs about stalking, and it makes it sound a lot cooler than what it technically is. But we're going to discuss that a little more in just a few minutes. So as Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Gonna Get Close to You, Stalkers. And there's a little nod in there to Queensryche with the title, and we'll discuss all that in a moment. So before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So what I thought I'd do tonight was talk about a phenomena that everybody knows, but they don't know they know, and they've probably never heard the official title for what this is. And the official title is Mondragon. So, and that was a coin. That was a term that was coined actually in 1954 by American writer Sylvia Wright. And it was in regards to something that her mother read to her from childhood. She used to read her a lot of, you know, classical stories like some of our parents did, and ballads and this sort of thing. And as a child, she was very fond of Percy's Reliques. And there's a Scottish ballad out of that called The Bonnie Earl of Moray. And there's a Lady Mondragon in there that is part of that whole thing. And so as her mother was reading her the ballad and listening to it, right, she remembers, ye highlands and ye lowlands, where, oh, where have ye be? They have slain the Earl of Moray and Lady Mondragon, right? But the correct line is, they laid him on the green. So she misheard the quote and had been memorized it as that since a kid. And so I thought it would be kind of fun to talk about the most common misheard lyrics in songs that people have done over the years that are called Mondragons after this Lady Mondragon, right? Because there's no Lady Mondragon, it's laid him on the green.
Okay. I see.
Isn't that cute? So yeah, that's how the term got started. And so she said for years she thought it was, and Lady Mondragon, and it was, and laid him on the green. So what I've done is I've taken a lot of the more common Mondragons in songs that you and I have heard over the years that some of us have misheard. And I thought I would give the most common ones that have come up over the years that I've heard my fellow musician people talk about, and in some cases listeners talk about, and in some cases when we talk about music with some of my folks that I work with, they're like, oh my God, I thought they were saying this. So I thought it'd be kind of, since we're going to be talking about a heavy subject, I thought I'd talk about something that's a little more light and colorful and funny. So I have 35 very common Mondragons that have been done over the years. The most common one that I think everybody probably knows is a line from Creedence Clearwater Revival's Bad Moon Rising, where I joked with one of my patients and said, well, at least you know if you're at a concert where to go to the Johns, yeah, if you're at a Creedence concert and you mishear this one, because everybody hears There's a Bad Moon on the Rise as There's a Bathroom on the Right. So I never heard that,
Lord.
A lot of a lot of people have heard that. I'm like, well, you know, the good news is if you're at a concert, you go to the right and, you know, you'll find the bathrooms. the other one that a lot of people have heard that I also never heard was from Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze, where he says, "Excuse me while I kiss the sky." And a lot of people seem to have thought, "Excuse me while I kiss this guy." Like, oops. Well, you know, you never know with some of these folks.
Well, that's plausible with him. Ostensibly, he was bi, so you never know.
Isn't that hilarious? Yeah. Well, and that's why I say, well, you know, you never know. So there's a couple on here that were really, really, I was like, how the hell did anybody get some of these messed up? But I mean, yeah, who knows? So the other one that I've heard before is a line from the Beatles, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, where they go, you know, the girl with kaleidoscope eyes. And
yeah.
Some people have heard that as the girl with colitis goes by. And I'm like, not unless she's got a bag with her.
<You know>?
another one I hear a lot is people mishearing the lyrics from the Tina Turner song that she sings, You're Simply the Best, where she goes, "You're simply the best, better than all the rest." Some people have heard that as "You're simply the best, better than an hour's rest." And I'm like, well, that's not a very high bar. the other one, which I've never heard before, is T-Rex had a song called Metal Guru. And there's a lyric in there called where he says, "Easy chew." And people have thought he said, "Is it you?" And I'm like, okay.
Oh.
Yeah, so with some of these, I'm like, you know, I can kind of see that. The bathroom on the right one, I've heard a lot. One I did not know until I started working with some British folks, and we were talking about misheard lyrics, and they said, yeah, a lot of people in the British, you know, the national anthem, you know, God Save the Queen, they you know, Britannia, you know, not the national anthem, but the Britannia, you know, Britannia go away, you know, Britannia never, 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 never shall be slaves. And some people mishear that as never, 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 never shall be saved. And I'm like, okay, that sounds like something that, you know, maybe the Sex Pistols were saying, you know, next to God Save the Queen. But anyway, Dylan's blowing in the Wind. When the answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind, people have heard as the ants are my friends, they're blowing in the wind.
Oh, God.
And I'm like, okay. The other one that I've heard occasionally, I haven't heard but one or two people says, so the old song off Keys and Songs in the Key of Life, which is probably my favorite Stevie Wonder album. The Sir Duke is just a great tune off that record. And there's a line in the chorus, you know, you can feel it all over. People have heard that as Mick and Phyllis are lovers. I don't know how you get that out of that, but. Rolling Stones, Beast of Burden. I'll never be your beast of burden. I'll never leave your pizza burning.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer. Doesn't make a difference if we make it or not. It doesn't make a difference if we're naked or not. Somehow I think it does. Yeah. yeah, Metallica's King Nothing, or, you know, at the end of that, he goes, "Where's your crown, King Nothing?" People have heard that as, "Where's your cornbread muffin?" I don't know how that happens, but yeah. A Tom Waits lyric that goes, "Doctor, lawyer, beggar, man, thief." That's been misheard as, "Dr. Laura, you pickled man, thief."
Well, that's special.
Yeah. Or this song, The Girl from Ipanema. The girl from Ipanema goes walking versus the girl with emphysema goes walking. I'm just where do you get these? I know. These are not made up things. I mean, these are like on the record things, right? No pun intended.
Yeah.
Carol King's Natural Woman, you know, Natural Born Woman, has a line in there that says, "You're the key to a piece of my mind," misheard as, "You're the cheese to my pizza mind." And here's one that's closely related, a food-related lyric. America the Beautiful. You know, America, America, God shed his grace on thee. Misheard as America, America, God is Chef Boyardee.
That's a stretch.
Yeah, here's another really well-known one that I had never heard of before I started talking to people. So in Stairway to Heaven, Led Zeppelin's, incredibly iconic song, the lyrics, and the last one when they started playing the heavy part where he goes, and then as we wind on down the road, right, there's a wino down the road. I mean, there probably is, but I don't think they're talking about that.
No, probably not.
Yeah. Steve Winwood's Higher Love, where he's singing the refrain, bring me a higher love. People have sometimes heard that as bring me a pie of love.
Well,
yeah.
That's fair.
The Ramones, I Want to Be Sedated. I Want a Piece of Bacon. I mean, I like bacon too, but somehow it just didn't fit that tune if you listen to the rest of the song.
Not so much.
Well, here's an even better one. The Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. The line, I sometimes wish I'd never been born at all.
Yeah.
I sometimes wish I'd never been boiled in oil.
Oh, God.
Yeah. There's a couple of Pink Floyd ones. One is from Another Brick in the Wall, where it's, where they say no dark sarcasm in the classroom, no Dukes of Hazzard in the classroom.
Well, yeah, you should wait till after class for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And only Daisy Duke, the other two guys can go home. Anyway, y'all, I'm from the South, I can say that. Okay, so Madonna's Material World lyrics, we are living in a material world and I am a material girl, sometimes heard as, I'm hearing a food theme here, we're living in a Cheerio world and I am a Cheerio girl.
Oh, that's painful.
Yeah, I'm like, were you on crack when you were listening to this? Bob Seger's Making Thunderbirds, where the lyrics are back in 55, we were making Thunderbirds. Misheard as back in 55, we were making fun that hurts, which they probably were, but that has nothing to do with Thunderbirds. Don Henley's Boys of Summer, where he says, I can see you, your brown skin shining in the sun. One of my favorite Don Henley songs, by the way. Misheard as I can see you, your bra straps shining in the sun. Or the Bruce Springsteen pen song that was made famous by Manfred Mann, Blinded by the Light.
I was waiting for this. This is my favorite
right?
one of these.
Oh, yeah. You knew that was coming, right? Revved up like a deuce, right? Which, for those who don't know what a deuce is, it's a hot rodder. I think it's a 1934 Ford coupe, if I'm not mistaken. I wouldn't know about cars that's on the head of a pin, but I did look that one up at one time listening to that. Because I probably misheard the same thing everybody else does, which is wrapped up like a douche. And I'm like, okay, well, there's a slight difference there. And I actually heard that for the first 10 or 15 times I heard it. And then I went, wait a minute, he's talking about hot rods. That can't be right. So I had to crank it up and I went, oh, wait a minute. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's another,
the first one I learned.
Yeah, here's another weird one. So Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. Here we are now. Entertain us. Two different mishearings. One of which I've never heard before. Here we are now. Hot potatoes. Or here we are now. In containers. I'm like, okay, that one makes more sense to me than the hot potatoes. At least from a mishearing standpoint. ABBA's Dancing Queen. See that girl, watch that scene, digging the Dancing Queen versus the misheard. See that girl, watch her scream, kicking the Dancing Queen. I mean, these things give a whole other meaning to the song. I just like, if you listen to the rest of the lyrics, none of your mishearings make sense, right? Pink Floyd's Comfortably Numb. right? Your lips move, but I can't hear what you say. Misheard as your legs move, but I can't hear what you say. Yeah, I guess not if your legs are moving and your lips aren't. The police is messaging a bottle, right? The lyrics of the last verse where it says, a year has passed since I wrote my note. A year is gone since I broke my nose. Yeah,
oh,
I know.
Oh, Lord.
Toto's Africa lyrics, there's nothing that 100 men or more could ever do. Misheard as, there's nothing that 100 men on Mars could ever do. I'm like, okay, well, yeah,
men,
I'm telling you, some of these you got to really stretch your ears and go, okay, were you guys on crack when you were listening to this stuff? Three Dog Nights, Joy to the World lyrics, Joy to the Fishes in the Deep Blue Sea, misheard as Joy to the Visions that the People See. And that one I could say, okay, you know what, that if you listen to that solution, that song, that one kind of makes sense. And knowing that most, you know, musician guys were druggies back in the day, I could see that. Steely Dan's Reeling in the Ears, the chorus, Are You Reeling in the Ears? Misheard as, Are You Ringing in the Ears? Which I guess if you turn your amps up loud enough, you probably will have ringing in your ears. Brian Adams's Summer of 69 lyrics. I got my first real six string, bought it at the Five and Dime. Misheard as, I got my first real sex dream. I was five at the time. Well, that's
wrong.
A precocious listener. That's a really precocious listener. I'm like, come on, people. Someone had, was reading too many Playboy magazines or something. Dire Straits, Money for Nothing, and Your Chicks for Free, right? One of my favorite tunes. Misheard as, Money for Nothing and Your Chips for Free. So I guess they have a sale on Doritos at the grocery store, 2 for 1.
I guess.
and the last one, the Boys in Heart song that was made famous, recorded by the Monkees. I'm a believer, and the chorus is, and I saw her face, now I'm a believer, and I saw her face, now I'm going to leave her.
not nice.
That must have been one ugly woman. Holy shoes. So those are 35 of the most common mondegreens in music that I thought would be kind of fun, and you can see that they traverse everything from heavy metal to prog rock to disco to pop stuff to, punk rock to, Latin jazz to acoustic-y kinds of stuff. I mean, to blues.
No,
I mean, there is no
genre is safe, apparently.
Yeah. Oh, and I forgot to mention, I missed one, Paul Young's Every Time You Go Away lyric. Every time you go away, you take a piece of me with you. Every time you go away, you take a piece of meat with you.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm thinking only if you were listening to the Scorpion song, Another Piece of Meat.
Oh, well, yeah, okay. In that case,
one of my all-time favorite Scorp songs with all three, both Shanker Brothers on it, and I think Uli Roth played on a couple of tunes on that. I guess that was his exit record, and their guy that's been with him forever that plays Explorer, and I can't think of his name. Oh, my gosh, that's ridiculous. But anyway, he's a really great guitar player, but I can't think of his name. But all three of those guys were playing on it. Because Rudolf Schenker is their rhythm player. He's the brother of Michael Schenker, who's just a phenomenal guitarist. Matthias Jobs. That's the guitar player. So Matthias Jobs has been with him ever since that record. But both he and Michael Schenker were playing on that, and I think Uli Roth is on a couple of songs too, which was he was making his exit as, and Michael was covering for him, and then they brought Matthias Jobs as their normal guy, and he's been with him ever since, and still with him. Anyway, those are the 35 most common mondegreens, some of which I knew, some of which I've heard over the years, and a couple of which I saw in the literature, and I'm like, okay then. So there you have it.
All righty. Cool. Well, thank you very much for that. Let's give you some thank you applause. If I get my button to work, do your thing.
Now, just given the seriousness of some of the stuff we're going to talk about, I thought we would lighten it up a bit, you know?
Yes, that's definitely fair. We're going to need a little balance with tonight's very serious subject. No kidding. All right, so if you guys want to talk about this, feel free to join us. We will be taking calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the rest of the evening up until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All right, so come stalk us. I'm just kidding, because that's one of the first things we're going to talk about, how that is misinterpreted and made light of, and that just contributes to the problem. So tonight's topic, going to get close to you, stalkers. All right, tonight's show is about a topic that, believe it or not, was a known problem for centuries, but only began to be legitimized and validated legally, psychologically, and societally in this country as recently as the 1990s. There was a big ruling in California about stalking. It was one of the first times we had legal protections in this country about it. So we're going to discuss stalking on tonight's show. Similarly to many other popularly known pathologies, stalking is known of by many, but through misinformation and lack of correct medical data in popular culture, traditional and social media, and entertainment sources, it is frequently mislabeled and overused incorrectly, mostly for dramatic effect. And the psychology behind stalking is complex and varied. So we do not offer a single diagnostic understanding of the behavior, but we will mention numerous iterations that one might encounter. So we hope tonight to help our listeners understand various behaviors frequently labeled as stalking and how to deal with situations that either legitimately qualify, as well as how to diffuse situations that might be unwanted or unpleasant but not properly stalking. So tonight we will discuss, and this is in no particular order, we're going a little freeform tonight as we sometimes have been doing lately, definitions, perspectives, and types of stalking, including casual, psychological, and legal, how to respond to a stalker, how to know if you may be engaging in stalker-type behavior. There were several articles I read prepping for this, and they interviewed different people, and some of the subjects really didn't understand that the things they were doing were stalking. So, you know, you may need to check in with yourself and make sure, especially if that's not what you're intending to do, that's definitely something to understand and stop as soon as you can. And we'll talk a little bit about resources and help for that. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything specific you want to bring up before we get going here.
Nope, I'm good. Thanks.
All right. So the first thing I want to talk about is definitions, perspectives, and types of stalking, including casual, psychological, and legal. So this is a collection of excerpts on stalking that provide some insight into various means of defining it. And what I will do is read these clips, and I'll check in with Dr. Mathis and see if there's anything he wants to expand on. All right, so this first one is an article overview, and it talks about several aspects of stalking, which is why I didn't divide it up into our traditional categories too much, because this article goes all over the place. So this is entitled The Seven Types of Stalkers and How to Spot Them, and many articles have the blah types of stalkers, you know, different numbers, but they're kind of saying the same basic things. So we can assume that this one will speak for several others just like it. All right, and the subheader for this was most stalkers are men, which I question, but this is what they assert. But female stalkers often share a similar approach. This was posted in May of 2016 by Dale Hartley, MBA and PhD. Dale was a retired professor of psychology and business. And he says, an estimated 12 to 16% of women and 4 to 7% of men will be stalked in their lifetime. The federal government and all 50 states have enacted anti-stalker statutes, yet there is still no universally accepted definition of what constitutes stalking. And in my opinion, I don't think there will be, for at least not for quite a long time. So he goes back to continue, when I talk about stalking, I'm referring to a pattern of behavior carried out by one person against another, which is intended to harass, intimidate, or terrorize the victim, and usually successfully does. Former spouses and paramours are the most common targets of stalking, followed by victims being stalked by an acquaintance. Only about 1 in 4 incidents involve stalking by a stranger. Most stalkers are men, 70 to 80%, as reported by various studies. It didn't cite a source for that. But one specific type of stalking is perpetrated almost exclusively by women, and they talk about that below. So the next part is a chunk of the same article. It is the 6 types of stalkers plus 1. So really the list is 7. I don't know why they put it this cute way, but anyhow, this part was brought up by Dr. Ronald Holmes, professor emeritus of criminology, and he proposes these categories of stalkers. Now, bear in mind, as a criminologist, these are not necessarily psychological categories. So he says, first one is domestic, stalking a former spouse or paramour. This is the most prevalent kind of stalking and one which can manifest in the workplace, putting innocent bystanders at risk. I'm not sure why these others couldn't manifest in the workplace either, but I digress. The second kind is lust. Serial predators who stalk victim after victim. Serial rapists and murderers may begin as lust stalkers, for example, Ted Bundy. Love scorned. An acquaintance, coworker, neighbor, etc., who desires an intimate relationship with the victim but is rebuffed. Parenthetically, a subtype of the love scorned stalker is someone with a delusional disorder, erotomania. This type of stalker, usually female, and that's what they were referring to above, believes her target is madly in love with her. The woman who repeatedly broke into David Letterman's home years ago and stole his car, claiming to be his wife, et cetera, is one example of this. Celebrity stalkers, those who stalk famous people, for example, John Hinckley. Political stalkers. Stalking motivated by political beliefs, which could include either agreement or disagreement with the victim, for example, Sirhan Sirhan. Hit stalkers, which is, in other words, murder for hire. Stalking of a victim by a hired killer in order to commit murder. Pretty straightforward. It's almost contractual. And Dr. Holmes says, I would propose adding one additional category to the list, revenge. An angry former employee, an aggrieved business partner, a resentful neighbor, a vindictive relative, or any other person usually known to the victim whose motive for stalking is payback. One example is the ex-con Max Cady in the movie Cape Fear, who stalks Sam Bowden, the lawyer who represented him at trial. There is no reliable profile to predict who is likely to stalk. Some patterns have begun to emerge from research, and although these fall short of providing a reliable checklist, what we've learned so far is interesting and could be useful. The following patterns apply to the United States population and may not necessarily apply to other nations. There's a bit of a cultural aspect to these lists. So in the United States, a stalker is likely to be unemployed or underemployed, late 30s to late 40s, high school or college graduate, more intelligent than most criminals, can be any race or ethnicity, mostly male, although erotomania is manifested overwhelmingly in females, and they are often delusional. In one study, clinical and personality disorders were present in more than half the stalkers evaluated. Generally, though, few stalkers are psychopathic, but some may be narcissistic, borderline, histrionic, or antisocial. And I'm going to pause here and see if Dr. Mathis would like to weigh in with anything regarding this article before we continue.
I would agree that a lot of the stalkers, at least the ones that I'm aware of, are cluster B personality disorders. There's no doubt about it. there's a high narcissistic component. Borderlines are very, very common. And so are certain categories of antisocial personality disorders, which I thought was interesting that the article says psychopathic, because most people equate antisocial personality, sociopathy, and psychopathy in the same bucket, even though they're not the same. A lot of people equate the three. But I would agree that most of them are cluster B personality disorders, and the ones I know are definitely that. The ones I've known are definitely underemployed or unemployed. I've known them in all ages. So the youngest one I've seen was 19 years old, and the oldest one I saw was a late 40s person, both of which had high school but no college education. And I wouldn't call them intelligent. I would call them their crimes are more well planned out, and they're not impulsive. Most of these people are not impulsive, even though, although some of the stalkers I've seen have been impulsive. They got pissed off or upset about something, and then they focused all their energies on it. But I did have one case where a person was autism spectrum E, and something would happen, and this person would misinterpret other people's behaviors and then stalk them as a revenge kind of thing. Harassment, kind of like to pay them back for misperceived offenses that they did that they didn't do. And all the stalkers I've ever seen have been male, with the exception of one. But I don't know the percentage in the population. That's something I definitely don't know. And I would some of the ones about I would say about half the ones I've seen have either been fully delusional or bordering on delusional behavior. They certainly had behaviors that weren't matching up with reality. Whether they would qualify as being full-blown delusional or not is another story. They certainly were misbeliefs. That's for daggum sure.
Gotcha. Okay, fair enough. Now let's go ahead and continue to the next article. This is sourced by Vice.com, and it's entitled "The Psychology Behind Stalking." Subtext, it's comforting to believe that we can easily spot a stalker, but people who engage in stalking actually vary far more widely than you'd expect. It was written by Christine Rowe in December of 2018. And she says, actually, people who exhibit the obsessive behavior associated with stalking, including following someone, sending unwanted gifts or communication, and staking out someone's home or work, vary much more widely than the cultural tropes portray. According to Michelle Gallietta, who is a clinician and psychology professor at City University of New York, who focuses on therapeutic treatments for stalkers and other groups, quote, there's no such thing as the typical stalker, end quote. Rather than a disorder in itself, stalking is a behavior that falls under the umbrella of symptoms for various disorders. According to a 2012 study published in the journal Aggression and Violent Behavior, quote, motivations for stalking include a delusional belief in romantic destiny, a desire to reclaim a prior relationship, a sadistic urge to torment the victim, or a psychotic over-identification with the victim and the desire to replace him or her, end quote. And stalkers can fall under a variety of diagnoses, including psychotic disorders, personality disorders, such as narcissistic personality disorder, and delusional disorders, such as erotomania, a belief that another person, often a prestigious person, is in love with you. Despite this variance, there are certain characteristics that pop up again and again among stalkers, according to research. For instance, in a 2014 survey published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 80% of stalking survivors reported that they knew their stalker in some way. There's also evidence that stalkers are often men in their 30s, and their targets are frequently women in their late teens and early 20s, although not always. Other studies have found that anger and insecurity, often stemming from childhood, are also common among stalkers, as is impulsiveness. What's the difference between being stalked by an ex-partner versus by a stranger? Representations of unhealthy relationship dynamics in pop culture can blur out our understanding of the difference between romantic persistence and threatening obsession. Rom-coms, romantic comedy shows, teach us that it's desirable for guys to, say, hire a private investigator to track us down. From the movie There's Something About Mary. Blare music late at night outside our window from the movie Say Anything with John Cusack. And generally follow women until we have finally agreed to date. Sawaria and other Bollywood films. I'm pretty sure there are United States-based films that do that too. I just don't know the titles offhand. As the stalker at the center of Carolyn Kepney's bestseller, You, that's the title, says to justify himself, quote, I have seen enough romantic comedies to know that romantic guys like me are always getting into jams, end quote. But in reality, stalking is a form of abuse. And current or former intimate partners are both the most common kind of stalker and often the most dangerous. An estimated 60.8% of all women who responded to the 2014 CDC survey reported that they were currently or previously in a romantic relationship with their stalker. And research shows that up to 80% of people in abusive relationships have been stalked within that relationship. What does therapy for a stalker look like? As most stalkers have limited interests, one therapeutic option, quote, is to just build resilience, connection to other things such as hobbies, says Galeano. We often see that there's this urge to contact someone, whether that's because of a psychotic belief or because of loneliness in someone or something like that. And then once they make contact, that feeling goes away for a little while. And so that's a mechanism that reinforces it. So we want to break that. We want to teach them to recognize that whatever that urge was earlier on and get a commitment for them to try something different, end quote. This aspect of trying something different can be very hard for stalking perpetrators. McEwen's clients tend to be in intense emotional states, whether negative or positive, when they engage in individual acts of stalking. But the relief or high that they get from stalking dissipates quickly. Quote, for some reason, and we're only starting to work out why, someone who stalks returns to that same emotional state rather than being able to move on, end quote, McEwen explains. Quote, this means that they need to keep managing their emotional state and they need to keep choosing socially inappropriate and potentially criminal strategies that involve intruding on the victim, end quote. Stalking treatment can be effective if very targeted, but generic treatment isn't likely to accomplish much, given the diversity of stalking behaviors, says Galeano. There's also limited understanding among psychologists, however, about how to make this treatment specific, she says. Quote, very few therapists are going to think to put stalking as the treatment target. They're going to be like, how's things going? How are your relationships? They're not going to be, do you have an urge to call the person? What do you do when you have the urge? What skill do you use? End quote. In her view, getting into the details of stalking behaviors and compulsions is more useful to rehabilitation than general supportive treatment. And here I'm going to pause at the end of that article and check in with you, Dr. Mathis.
Well, from my perspective, it's like any other disorder. You've got to get at the core issues. Otherwise, they're going to do symptom substitution just like at addicts. It's the same kind of dynamic. So if you find out what's at the cause, what does the stalking represent, what's at the core that's missing in the person that the stalking is filling, if you can get to the underlying pathology or underlying stuff and attack that while putting a lid on the stalking id, so to speak, and use distracting behaviors for the person to put a lid on it, that's much more effective. I would agree that you can't just, you know, okay, how's it going? What are you doing? Are you keeping busy? I mean, you have to really get at what the person's thought processes are and What are they doing to attack the underlying issues that are causing them to want to stalk and become obsessed with this person to begin with? Because if you don't do that, they're just going to symptom substitute, and then something else will come up, and they'll switch gears and go to the other thing. It's just like addiction.
Okay, fair enough. And I can certainly see that if you don't get to the root of it, it's just going to be swapping one thing out for another.
Yep. And that's right. Part of the reason why I do so much testing when somebody comes in, because I want to see what the core issues are. I don't – the surface behavior, whether it's, you know, stalking, depression, addictions, whatever, those are symptoms of what's causing those problems. And I want to get at what's causing those problems, because if I can do that and get the person to solve those issues, the surface stuff goes away.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's go to the next part where I've grouped SNPs from a couple of articles into categories, primarily stuff that is a psychological perspective and some stuff that's a legal perspective. So there are several clips here from an article that comes from ScienceDirect.com, and it's actually a peer-vetted paper, and these are just abstracts and comments. I don't actually have access to the full paper because I'm not an academician on that site. So I thought the clips might be helpful in generating some discussion. So I went ahead and used them anyway. All right, so this first one is Chapter 1, The Psychology of Stalking. All of these are sourced from ScienceDirect.com but have different authors. This one is J. Reed Malloy, Ph.D., who's an associate clinical professor of psychiatry and an adjunct professor. This chapter emphasizes that recognizing the force of fantasy as a central component of intense emotion and inexplicable behavior is the first step in understanding the psychology of stalking. Stalking is a crime involving acts of pursuit of an individual over time that are threatening and potentially dangerous. Clinical definitions of stalking vary, but tend to be more easily operationalized and measurable than legal definitions. The next clip is Chapter 3, Developmental and Social Antecedents of Stalking. And this is Christine K. Kindland, PsyD, who's a clinical and forensic psychologist. And this says, stalking is generally defined as an individual's persistent unwanted pursuit or obsessional harassment of another person, causing him fear of bodily injury. Individuals who stalk exhibit a broad range of behaviors, motivations, and psychological traits. This chapter describes attachment behavior as any form of behavior that results in a person attaining or retaining proximity to some other differentiated and preferred individual. The central theme of object relations theory is that early caretaking relationships are internalized and transformed into a sense of self. An individual's development during four subphases determines the degree of separateness that is achieved and influences the individual's sense of self and relationships. Differentiation enables a child to be aware of the mother's separateness. Practicing enables a child to play an active role in determining closeness and distance. Rapprochement involves a child's rapid attainment of new skills and independence with continued assistance. Libidinal object constancy develops the stable inner representation of the mother so that the child is able to function independently in the mother's absence. This chapter summarizes that stalkers are a diverse group with a complex array of disturbed attachment styles and a variety of mental disorders. All right. Next part is from Chapter 4, Psychiatric Diagnosis and the Offender-Victim Typology of Stalking. And the author of this section is Michael Zona, MD, who has a diplomate, and it mentions principal, but Dr. Mathis, can you shed some light on what that means in this context? Because I'm sure it's not school principal. I'm sure it's something else.
I would assume that he's the principal author.
Okay. All right.
Perhaps the principal researcher in this, but yeah, he's probably not a school principal.
Yeah, I figured that wasn't it, but I wasn't quite clear.
And generally, if you have somebody who's a principal author, they'll have research assistants or doctoral students are working under them, and they'll indicate that they're, you know, a doctoral candidate or a doctoral student or that kind of thing, working under these folks.
And funny you should mention that, the next name on the author's list, Russell Pelleria, M.A., who's a clinical psychology doctoral candidate. Ta-da! And
now
then
there you have
followed,
it.
Yep, followed by John Lane, Jr., M.P.A., who is also a principal.
Okay,
and
there you go.
And the publisher summary for this one is, until the early 1990s, knowledge concerning the psychology and behavior of stalkers was limited, as I mentioned in the beginning. Most people who were aware of this phenomenon probably viewed the issue in terms of an individual who repeatedly attempt to make contact with a celebrity for a variety of purposes. There have been several attempts to characterize the various stalking behaviors and relationships that are described in this chapter. The most fundamental aspect of these individuals is that they portray a behavior. In psychiatric and psychological disease processes, many of the symptoms are expressed in cognitive and or behavioral patterns. Stalkers who suffer from thought disorders typically have Axis 1 diagnosis of schizophrenia or one of the various types of delusional disorders. This chapter highlights a watershed event that occurred in 1989 with the murder of actress Rebecca Schaefer by a stalker named Robert Bardo. In contrast to the domestic violence type case, many relationships involve nothing more than brief dating, with one of the two partners deciding not to continue the contact. A rejection which is not handled well when relationship ends results in vengeance. And the last abstract of this category is Chapter 5, The Archetypes and Psychodynamics of Stalking. And this is written by Glenn Scholar, PhD, who's a clinical and forensic psychologist. And it says, this chapter discusses that the relationship of stalking, as well as the associated explicit or implicit threat of violence, to the more rare commission of actual violence, is empirically unclear and frequently unpredictable in cases of political, celebrity, and relationship stalking. For years, criminal justice experts have been reasonably frustrated with outdated Freudian mother complex or father complex Oedipal theories, as well as the less sophisticated but trendier inner wounded child portrayals of criminal offenders. Among the most famous tortured and actual love obsessions in Western literature is Shakespeare's sonneteering erotomania for his spurning dark lady, the woman colored ill. This is something that goes on in his sonnets, for those of you that are a little bit lost here. He writes several of them to a dark lady, and we don't actually know who she is. We have theories. All right, so in the penultimate Dark Lady sonnet, Shakespeare combines feelings of sexual betrayal with explicit phallic double meanings in a manner pathetically suggestive of Oedipal stimulation and frustration. This chapter also emphasizes that along with projective identification, political celebrity and relationship stalkers can employ primitive defenses of projection as well, which can take several murderous paths. The feminist perspective does not fully explain why women can become just as delusionally and erotic, maniacally obsessed as men. And my comment here is, why wouldn't a woman be capable of equal obsession just due to her gender? I found that to be an odd comment. And with that, I'm going to pause here on the psychological section and check in with you, Dr. Mathis.
Yeah, and my response to that is they are capable of equal obsession. In my opinion, this is not limited to gender. You might see guys exhibiting the behaviors more, for lack of a better term, obviously than women, because that's what guys do. They're more actor-outers. I had this discussion with somebody earlier today. They're more actor-outers, where women tend to be more actor-inners, more ruminators and sufferers and silent sort of thing. But I think what you're seeing is as women are getting more, you know, equality with men, they're gaining more equality in the disordered arena too. And they're feeling freer to do the same kind of behaviors they would not be free to do from a societal standpoint in bygone years, and I think they're quite capable of it.
That's what I figured. All right. So the next chunk that I want to talk about is SNPs that kind of have a legality and criminal perspective. And just as a reminder, note, we are not attorneys, and this information is asserted by other people in ways that we are professionally unable to credibly verify. So this should not be taken as final legal advice of any kind. If you actually need legal advice, go take our notes and go to an actual attorney and ask them. All right, so Chapter 2, The Legal Perspective on Stalking. This is written by Rhonda Saunders, JD. And she says, the California legislature passed the first anti-stalking law in 1990. Stalking is a continuous crime, and all stalking statutes require at least two or more incidents to constitute the crime. California's stalking law required that a stalker make a, quote, credible threat of death or great bodily injury, end quote, towards the victim, placing the victim in reasonable fear of the same. As a direct result of a particular case, California's stalking law was amended in 1994. The new law states that any person who willfully, maliciously, and repeatedly follows or harasses another person and who makes a credible threat with the intent to place that person in reasonable fear for his or her safety or the safety of his or her immediate family is guilty of the crime of stalking, end quote. Stalkers' continued actions can, and in some cases do, lead to murder or serious injury. Strong state stalking laws, if properly utilized, could prevent tragedies from occurring. And my commentary here is, you know, many people casually use the term to refer to obsessive following even without threat, unwanted attention, and, quote, cyber stalking to mean pursuit online, from collecting media and photos to unwanted messages. You know, is this valid today? I don't know if you have an opinion about that, Dr. Mathis, whether this, you know, people call
when
that stalking
valid,
and cyber stalking.
What do you mean when you say valid? Do you mean legally defensible? I mean, legally prosecutable? What do you mean by that?
Well, my general point is that a lot of people frequently use the word stalking, and some of the behavior may be unusual or obsessive in some way, but I think it falls short of what
uh-huh.
we really call stalking. So I guess I'm pointing at hyperbole that's common in our pop culture, and especially when it comes to online, because it's so easy to just start downloading someone's pictures. But does that make you a stalker? It makes you kind of a weirdo and a little obsessed,
yeah.
But I think stalking is a bit much, and I kind of
yeah,
wanted your take on
okay, I think it becomes, you know, you call it what you want. For me, it becomes harmful when somebody starts to act on it, or they start to act on it even online, so it becomes a form of bullying. I wouldn't, you know, it's only stalking. I mean, you can be obsessed with somebody. I mean, it's like fans are obsessed with bands or football teams or, you know, soccer players or whatever, and they collect things and they follow them online and they tweet them and they have commentaries and stuff. I don't think anybody would call that stalking, but that is an obsession that people have with certain celebrities or persons in the news, whether they're politicians or musicians or whatever. To me, that's a different phenomena than somebody saying mean and nasty and hurtful and harassing and threatening things in a bullying sort of way online, which I see much more often.
Okay, that's definitely fair. All right, so the next comment is from Chapter 6, The Victims of Stalking, and this is by Doris M. Hall, Ph.D., who's an assistant professor. And it says, this chapter highlights that stalking cases stimulate a good deal of interest. Unfortunately, the tendency is to look at the more glamorous and sensational aspects of stalking rather than the more common characteristics. There's a common misperception regarding the stalking victim. The most popular image is that of a celebrity who is stalked by a crazed fan or a battered woman who has left a physically abusive relationship and is now being stalked by her ex-spouse or ex-lover. The emphasis on the victim allows researchers to uncover valuable information that is not available through official records or from interviewing individual offenders. Male respondents feel that their gender is a handicap in stalking situations, especially if they were being stalked by females. Most of the research to date is from a feminist bent, investigating the effect of victimization of women. Little is known about the victimization of men, despite the fact that most victims of violence are men. They didn't give a source for this, and I kind of question it, but that's what they said. This chapter also emphasizes that the majority of stalking victims are women who are being stalked by men who wish to either reestablish or initiate a relationship with them. Chapter 7. Actually, I'm going to pause right here. Is there anything that you want to add about the part I just read, Dr. Mathis? I don't want to like plow too far ahead in the topic without giving you a chance to talk about it.
No, I'm good with what you said. I just, I think a lot of the reported victims of stalking are women. I don't think they're men. I'm not suggesting men aren't victims of stalking, because they are, but I think more victims are reported in the media and in the justice system as being victims or women. But I certainly, I don't think that most victims of violence are men. Most victims of other kinds of violence are men, not stalking violence. So things like murder, minus things like rape, even though obviously men are raped too, even outside of the federal prison system. I think the violence they're talking about is like, ballroom brawls and shootings and murders and that sort of thing. Most of the reported victims of violence in a stalking situation are women.
Gotcha. It seems like there's a bit of a psychology to the reporting, the act of letting somebody know what's going on.
Uh-huh.
There seems to be, different categories with that as well. And I think that may skew the results, because it means some people just don't come forward. So
that is correct.
It's probably part of the reason that we're fuzzy about the whole thing, is because we can't get people to be truthful. Okay.
Right. Absolutely.
That makes sense.
Absolutely.
All right.
No,
so
that's absolutely
the next The next chapter is Chapter 7, Stalking and Domestic Violence, somewhat related. That's why I grouped these together. This is by Lenore E. Walker, ED.D, Executive Director, and also J. Reed Malloy, PhD, that I mentioned earlier. This chapter explores the identification of domestic violence as a major social, legal, and health problem, with the potential to destroy millions of families. Domestic violence has been conceptualized as an abuser's attempt to use physical, sexual, or psychological force to take away a woman's power and control over her life. I have to object to the gendering in here, but all right. The studies of damaging relationships have elucidated the dynamics that force their progress until the woman feels like she's been imprisoned. Most battering relationships do end in divorce, often putting the women at the highest risk for further harm or actual death from the point of separation to about 2 years post-divorce. Stalking is the name given to a group of behaviors that batterers do to keep the relationship between themselves and their partners from being detached. The battered woman's checklist presented in this chapter often helps a battered woman or her family and friends to evaluate whether there's abuse in the relationship. The mandatory reporting laws for domestic violence and subsequent court-ordered treatment programs in the United States have recently provided better access to the understanding of abusive men. Chapter 8, and then we've got one more to go, because I do know that we're running over time, but not too badly. So Chapter 8 is the stalking of clinicians by their patients. And this is John R. Lyon, MD, who's a clinical professor of psychiatry. Also with Jeremy Hirschler, MD, who's an addictions fellow. This chapter reflects on the knowledge and participation with several dozen cases in which patients or their relatives have formed pathologic attachments to clinicians. It discusses 9 case examples to depict the different forms of stalking of clinicians by their patients. The first case study deals with the complexities of confrontation and prosecution. In this case, a psychiatrist took on the treatment of a borderline patient with a history of sexual abuse and intermittent suicidal ideation. The second case examples deal with a male psychiatry resident in training who agreed to take up treatment of a 39-year-old borderline woman prone to alcohol abuse and self-mutilation. In the third case, a 40-year-old female psychiatrist and single parent practicing in a large academic teaching hospital agreed to treat a 20-year-old who had a borderline personality disorder. The fourth case illustrates the problem of telephone harassment. The fifth case reveals the scope of stalking behavior and the impact it can have on a clinician's professional life. On the whole, the clinician should be attuned to early unsuitable behaviors that mirror an unbalanced change. And I'm actually going to pause here and see if there's anything you want to add to that particular chapter, Dr. Mathis.
No, but I would make a comment. Well, two things. I agree with your comment about the sexist thing because I see abuse happening in same-sex relationships as well, both with men and women. So this is definitely not a heterosexual phenomenon by any means.
Yeah.
It just some of the gay couples report it less because of the shame factor, particularly with males. In terms of the clinicians, I think we were talking before the show started that I've actually had a couple of stalking cases myself. And very, very interesting. It's interesting. That's all I can say. It's an interesting phenomenon. Fortunately, I've only had a couple, and they were handled very not. You know, I'm not suggesting I was the greatest thing since sliced bread, but I handled them pretty well, and they ended pretty well. And you know, one of them didn't end that well for the individual, but the other ones ended very amicably, and you know, there was a resolution, and that was good. But sometimes it gets real nasty. But I was happy that they things ended without a whole lot of fanfare, which is always a good thing in my mind. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, and the last chapter that I want to read to you guys is Chapter 9, Preventing Attacks on Public Officials and Public Figures, a Secret Service Perspective. And this is Robert Fine that we mentioned earlier, consulting psychologist to the United States Secret Service and visiting fellow. And there's an abbreviation I don't know, ASAIC. Does that mean anything to you, Dr. Mathis?
No, my guess would be something to do with government. That's probably a governmental, the American Society of Stalkers or something. Or you know, I have no clue.
Okay.
I mean, you got me on that one.
Yeah, but that is associated with Brian Vasquil. K-U-I-L. I'm butchering it, but sorry about that, Brian. So they worked on this chapter together. And this chapter deals with the prevention of attacks on public officials and public figures, which is a Secret Service perspective. Assassination of political leaders and other public figures is a rare but significant problem in the United States. The chief goal of the special case study project is to collect information and increased knowledge that might help law enforcement organizations to accomplish defensive responsibilities for public officials and public figures. The study plan involved two kinds of data collection and review. First, all available archival information about each subject was gathered and coded. Second, interviews were conducted with living subjects. A number of key observations, I don't know how they would conduct an interview with dead subjects, but that's a digression. A number of
maybe
key
using a medium.
Possibly.
By the way, that abbreviation means assistant special agent in charge.
Ah, okay, so you were correct. Yeah, it was a political thing. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. A number of key observations about assassins and their behaviors have emerged from the Secret Service Exceptional Case Study Project (ECSP). Targets are selected on the basis of a subject's motives, not primarily because of a subject's feelings about or hostility towards a particular target or office. An assassination attempt is the end result of a process of thinking and behavior. Many attackers and near-lethal approachers move through life on a path that leads them to consider assassination of one or another prominent person of public status. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything you want to add.
Nope, I'm good.
All right. So let's go ahead and wrap this up. In summary, we hope now that our listeners now better understand stalking, and we hope that you have been empowered to be able to appropriately and accurately identify stalking behavior should it ever happen to you, or if you need to understand that you might have ended up doing it inadvertently towards another person. Sometimes there are people who don't realize that what they're doing is really freaky because maybe they've never had it done to them or known anybody who did. But, you know, hopefully tonight you'll be better able to navigate that from whichever end might be relevant. So this concludes our show, Gonna Get Close to You on Stalkers. And I assume, Dr. Mathis, that you don't have any further commentary. So assuming I'm correct, feel free to stop me if I'm not. On behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation also to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, July 7th, 11 p.m., right here on blogtalkradio.com. We also want to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow, Thursday, Travel It's Radio, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Sometimes in the world of travel, a location is responsible for producing a superior product. That is the case with the Licini Mountains of northern Italy, peaks 1,500 feet above sea level that yield spring water straight into the production facility for Better Than Milk, a healthful drink with plant-based ingredients. Ingredients of Better Than Milk come from sustainable organic farms in Italy, Finland, and Denmark. Hear all about the product and its European roots when Travel It's Radio presents Kevin Ryder, Senior Brands Manager for Panos Brands, P-A-N-O-S, parent company of Better Than Milk. Listen live as Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee host the 418th episode of Travel It's Radio, now in its 10th season. As usual, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. That'll be on the 26th. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. The 27th, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, The Walking Dead online viewing party is on hiatus. We believe until Walking Dead returns with Season 11 on August 22nd. There may be shows before that. We will keep you updated as it gets announced by AMC. Please feel free to join us online or on the air by phone for real-time discussions, updates, trivia, profiles on the cast and crew, and more. Monday at 10 p.m., Monday Night in America with Roger Dean Noriega, who brings his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. The Nightmare Hunter with Roger Noriega has moved to Tuesday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Streamlabs. And Monday Night in America is also now on Streamlabs. Tuesday at 10 p.m. here on Blog Talk Radio is Fandom Access Week in Review. Join the terrific trio of Jamie, Karen, and AJ as they dig into another night of TV. Please look for the Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us. See you next time, and rock on. Good night.